It's 9 o'clock in the morning. This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination, that is, of the news you're not supposed to know. We'll get to the exhumations later. I want to let you know that I'm going to be live tweeting the Senate impeachment removal trial Tuesday. And, of course, there is a 3-hour difference between the East Coast and the West. So if it's starting at 10 a.m., for example, then I'll be tweeting at 7. And if they're starting at 8 in the morning, well, I'll be tweeting at 5 a.m. And you better believe that I'm going to have my impeachment tree up and get out the impeachment goodies, make special impeachment coffee, and just really enjoy the hell out of it and try to tweet something relevant. And as you may know, the scene is changing, as what looked to be an immediate and facile dismissal, it may be turning into something more complicated. I mean, to be real, it's going to be a somewhat more complicated dismissal, I'm sure. But we can always hope, can't we? And in any event, it's an historic event. So that's at KBOO Press Watch on Twitter. By the way, you can also follow me on Facebook under my name. You get to guess which one is me. And today, I'm going to be joined in just a few minutes by Arun Gupta, journalist and commentator for The Intercept, previously for The Guardian, a person whose voice is very much significant in the debate about immigrant rights and about the encroachment of fascism in this country. So I'll be looking forward to that. But first, these three headlines. In Puerto Rico, 8,000 people are living in shelters, that's the official number, and an unknown number are scattered into tents as a bizarre series of earthquakes continues on the southwest side of the island. Power's been knocked out again, and people, American citizens, are still waiting for most of the hurricane disaster relief that was supposed to have been delivered a year ago. 700 houses in Guanica are heavily damaged, and even bees are leaving their homes as the quakes continue. Something like a quarter of the bees are leaving their hives. The fault system responsible for the quakes is not on previously known active major tectonic plate intersections, and residents are fearful that exploratory fracking activity has triggered some threshold that will have unknown catastrophic consequences. The USGS determined in 2013 that there is 244 billion cubic feet of natural gas in the immediate offshore area, and you know that got the attention of the petroleum companies. A petition on change.org is calling for an end to fracking detonations around the island, postulating that they are responsible for the earthquakes and intimating that the fossil fuel industry should pay for the quake damage. The Department of Energy denies that there is fracking offshore or on the 35-mile-long island, but residents are suspicious that loud explosions heard offshore by several persons may be related to exploration. There is also the matter of the odd selection of a fracking company from Oklahoma for disaster electrical restoration following the hurricanes. Quoting a 2017 article by Alexia Campbell for Vox, quote, an Oklahoma-based fracking company announced it had also signed a contract. This is a four-month, $200 million contract with a subsidiary of Mammoth Energy called Cobra Energy. Their job is to design and build a new electric grid for Puerto Rico. The CEO of Mammoth says Cobra has electrical experience in the Midwest, but according to Mammoth's website, the company's deeper expertise is in drilling and fracking, including pressure pumping services, well services, natural sand and proppant services, contract and directional drilling services, and other energy services, end quote. My angle here is that an administration as deeply committed to disinformation as Trump's deserves the accusation, and in any event, needs to step up with immediate and substantial aid to our fellow citizens in Puerto Rico. Also, the corporate press needs to give the story the same urgency it would have if the quakes were hitting Sandusky or Peoria. The new Queen of Bolivia is consolidating her rule with U.S. assistance. Prensa Latina reports, quote, the Bolivian Plurinational Constitutional Court today accepted the extension of the mandate of Jeanine Añez, self-proclaimed interim president, until the installation of the new government after the May 3rd elections. The court also agreed to extend the mandate of the senators and parliamentarians, all of whom were to finish their terms on the 22nd in accordance with the constitution of Andean Amazonian country. Añez proclaimed herself constitutional president on November 12th in the context of a coup d'etat against Evo Morales. Morales resigned from office on Sunday, November 10th, forced by top military and police officials to avoid bloodshed. That's the end of the quote from Prensa Latina. And when they're talking about the May 3rd elections, they're talking about U.S.-propped sham elections in the context of armed intimidation, deadly armed intimidation of the entire indigenous population. From thenewdaily.com, in Australia, as global temperatures soar, Australia could become so hot and dry that the country's residents could become climate refugees, according to U.S. climatologist and geophysicist Michael Mann. Australia is in the midst of one of its worst fire seasons on record, with bushfires burning since September and claiming nearly 30 lives, killing more than a billion animals and raising forests and farmland the size of Bulgaria. Some fires were so monstrous they created their own weather pattern, causing dry lightning and fire tornadoes as a three-year drought left woods tinder dry. Reuters quoted Dr. Mann, who is director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University, saying, quote, "It is conceivable that much of Australia simply becomes too hot and dry for human habitation. In that case, yes, unfortunately, we could well see Australians join the ranks of the world's climate refugees," end quote. And now I'm joined by Arun Gupta, as I was saying, journalist and commentator, someone whose articles you may have read on immigration, on the fascism that has been plaguing the Northwest. And I don't know where Arun is, so I'll just have to ask Arun, where are you now?
Well, you know, I'm based in New York, but I travel all over the U.S. Reporting. Currently, I am in Tejas, Texas, reporting on the immigration crisis at the border.
Are you in Brownsville?
I was in Brownsville. I just left Brownsville. I spent 4 days there reporting from Brownsville, but mainly reporting from Matamoros, Mexico, the refugee camp there, which is heartbreaking and horrifying, but also...
You still there?
Illegally blocked by Trump from getting into the United States because he shut down the asylum process in violation of all sorts of U.S. laws.
All right, and that is what I wanted to ask you about first, then, is the condition of people in the Matamoros camps, and I haven't been hearing good things about that.
It's a little complicated. I want to be fair. Estimates are hard to come by, but the latest estimates are that 56,000 asylum seekers are strung out along the border from El Paso to Matamoros. That's basically from the Pacific Ocean to the Gulf of Mexico, seven different border cities. Matamoros probably has some of the best conditions, and so that's why people are going there. There's basically a witness at the border a movement that is growing there, where what activists and, you know, just a lot of concerned people from all across the country, and they're encouraging other people to come down and coming there to witness what is going on in Mexico, to provide aid, to provide compassion. And then on the U.S. side, they're trying to raise hell, protest, go into the courts to document the bias process. But in the camps themselves, the Mexican government has finally come in and started to create some basic infrastructure. So for example, there's now, you see these giant water containers that are scattered throughout the camp, maybe about a dozen of them. They're building showers, there's laundry. One of the main organizing groups, Team Brownsville, brings over dinner for and feeds 1,000 people every day. And when we were there, there was, you know, church groups, there was a synagogue, congregation from Washington, D.C., Addis Israel, where one night They served the meal, and then the next night they paid for the meal and prepared it and then served it, making food for 1,000 different people. One woman from Texas, from Houston, has moved down there. Her name's Felicia, and she started a sidewalk school. The Mexican government has given them a space, and 3 days a week they're providing a school for the children. There's something like 500 children there, but it's limited. There's also healthcare. There's this NGO called Global Response Management, which is medical care. They have a clinic. They have these MASH units so they can treat people. Any serious surgery, they send people to hospitals.
Sounds like it's becoming a semi-permanent refugee camp situation with that many people. It almost sounds like descriptions of refugee camps on, say, the Turkish border.
Well, that's what it absolutely is. It is a refugee camp.
There is also reports from themonitor.com by Aaron Sheridan saying that 100 demonstrators from across the nation walked up and down past the port of entry at the Gateway International Bridge in Brownsville this past Sunday. There's an article about that. You can find it at themonitor.com. It sounds like they have room back.
I'm here. I can hear you.
Okay.
We were there for the first day of the witness hearing. There were, I think, more than 150 protesters at one point. Like I said, we've been going into the camp where there's this kind of growing infrastructure, so the conditions are somewhat better. But the thing is, the Mexican government does not want to declare them refugees, because if they did, that would mean the UNHCR would be able to come in, that this would trigger all sorts of obligations for both Mexico and the United States under international law. People there are fleeing horrific violence. The stories we've heard, of family members being assassinated by gangs. We heard the story of one family from Honduras. Their son was recruited by gangs. They came up to him and said, "Are you ready to join? And if you don't join, we're going to kill you." All the members of his family, he has a different father than the family who fled with his mother, and all the members of his family have either been killed or they've fled to either Costa Rica or southern Mexico. We talked to another gentleman from Central America. I don't want to identify him too much because these people are targets. He and his entire family was kidnapped in Monterrey, Mexico, and they were held for 22 days. They got off a bus from Central America. And the crazy thing about his story is he was essentially a civil servant, but he worked, so he didn't have a high position. But he worked in one of the highest institutions in the country, in the federal institutions, and they weren't able to protect him. A family member of theirs was killed, again, by drug cartels, and they went to the police and filed a report. So then the drug cartels started targeting them. And when they got to Monterrey, two pickup trucks full of armed men accosted them, threw them in the back of the truck. They took them to some remote location and held them. They're demanding $20,000. Relatives in the U.S. paid $6,000 to free two of them, and the rest of them escaped. But this included children, and the gentleman said that these people, they don't care about life. They'll just kill you. They've also escaped two other kidnapping attacks. And the thing is, it's the U.S. who is putting them at risk. So with these kidnapping attempts, they had to go to court. I believe it was in this city across from Nuevo Laredo in Mexico. When people come out of court onto the Mexican side, because this is the Trump policy, the Remain in Mexico, where they're booting the asylum seekers, and they have this just Orwellian name called Migrant Protection Protocols. As soon as people are coming out of court, they're kidnappers there trying to kidnap them. And so they were nearly kidnapped coming out of court. And now they're in relative safety in Matamoros, but they have to go back to Nuevo Laredo, and they have to go through some of the most dangerous areas in the world for their court case. And they said, at every town there was a cartel checkpoint, and basically if you don't pay them, they'll kill you.
That was terrifying.
Yeah, so this is, you know, what the Trump administration doing is creating these killing fields. And this, the entire policy, you know, we're talking to experts who are down there. This strengthens the cartels, right? Because the harder you make it to come into the U.S., the more that people will want to be smuggled. And it means that it's the cartels who really benefit, because they control the smuggling. You're making people, you're criminalizing them more and more, so they end up having to turn to the real criminals, the cartels, to smuggle them from area to area. It strengthens the cartels, which gives them more power. And one of the experts we talked to said, you know, Mexico is not a failed state. It's a strong state. It's just in the wrong hands, that this is a cartel state, you know, because they are working hand in hand with the government. We talked to two men from Cuba who were kidnapped by police in Monterrey, and they were freed after their relatives in the U.S. And same with the other case. It was relatives in the U.S. And one expert was telling us that billions of dollars a year are being extorted from relatives in the U.S. to these cartels through these kidnappings. So this is just a really horrifying picture that's going on here. And, you know, it's one person called it migrant genocide, because they are being targeted because they are migrants. And estimates are that over the last 15 years, something like 100,000 migrants have perished in Mexico trying to make the journey north. So the people we're talking to are by definition the ones who have survived this deadly journey. And it shows how desperate they are, that, you know, they're not leaving here for free. They're not coming to the U.S. for free stuff. They're just absolutely desperate to live. Nobody wants to leave their home.
Out of the frying pan into the fire. Well,
yeah, and
go ahead. Well, while we're waiting for that audio to come back in,
policy is completely, the Trump administration policy is completely illegal. That it is a criminal policy. And so, you know, when we hear all this stuff about illegal Trump administration.
I'm speaking with Arun Gupta.
Can you hear me?
I can now. Go ahead. We've had increasing interruptions.
Yeah, sorry about that. I'm outside on high ground holding the phone up. So I'm trying to do the best I can here, and it's raining. So, you know, the entire Trump administration policy is completely criminal, which is what's important to understand. And as bad as, say, the Democrats have been, this is just far worse than what they have done. The complete shutting down of asylum, the complete criminalization, the terrorizing of the immigrants, the shutting down of refugees. You know, it is just an absolute war on immigrants that is going on. And, you know, every immigrant advocate person, not, you know, people who are in social media and know everything but do nothing. Every immigrant advocate and immigrant rights activist will tell you what's going on is far worse, that this is fascistic in terms of what the Trump administration is doing. And in my opinion, you know, these refugee camps.
And can you start with, in your opinion, these refugee camps?
In my opinion, these refugee camps and concentration camps will eventually turn into death camps. There's not a guarantee that'll happen, but that's the road that we are on.
Seems to be the nature of concentration camps if we look at the 20th century. Well, now I want to tie this to fascism more generally. And when I contacted you, I was talking about what is going on in Richmond, where right-wingers hope to instigate Civil War II electric boogaloo. And the latest news on that is came in this morning in response to what he described as credible intelligence of threats of violence at an upcoming gun rights rally in Richmond, Virginia. The governor, Ralph Northam, has declared a state of emergency and will temporarily ban individuals from carrying firearms on Capitol grounds. This is from Vice.com. They write, the governor said at a press conference Wednesday that authorities believe armed militia groups plan to storm the Capitol during a January 20th rally. And you, Arun, have reported on the decision to target Portland, Oregon, as a city to be punished for its progressive and left policies by the national right. Do you have any comments on that? I mean, I bring this up, and this ties in, of course, because the wall and the cruelty towards immigrants at the border is part of President Trump's white supremacy program.
Yeah, so what's going on in Virginia is there's an organization, the name of it is the Virginia Citizens Defense League. They are a self-proclaimed extremist organization. They actually say we're that there's nothing wrong with being extreme, that we are proud to be categorized as an extremist organization. People may know the founder of it. He actually was appeared on the Sacha Baron Cohen show, Who is America. They convinced him to film a gun trading video for toddlers. That's how extreme these people are. Now they're welcoming, they're calling on militias to show up, and you know they're saying that there's enough armed citizens to take over a modern mid-sized country, and they're saying we welcome our militia brothers and sisters. And one of the groups that they've invited in is the Oath Keepers, which is an organization that includes current and retired military and law enforcement personnel. The thing is, what they're saying is we're upholding the Constitution, but it's their interpretation, whatever they decide the Constitution is, they will essentially rebel violently if they decide that they don't like what's going on. So it's people who are in effect endorsing armed insurrection. And the leader of the Oath Keeper, Stuart Rhodes, they're...
Okay, We've lost the audio just for a moment, and while we wait for that to get back, Arun, it sounds like you are back. I want to say that I've got Kathy Marie Carlson on the line also. She says she just spent 2 weeks in Brownsville, and let me see if I can get her on the line for a moment. Are you there, Kathy?
Hi, yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. What did you see in Brownsville?
Oh, well, all the things he just talked about, that a little more... from a different angle. I was there working with Teams Brownsville, cooking those meals, loading them into cars, taking them to the bus station, putting them in wagons, and hauling them across the bridge in these little wagons to feed 1,000 people. I found it very disturbing. I mean, they do have a camp, and Teams Brownsville has succeeded by raising a lot of funds, $57,000, to get... to take water from the Rio Grande and make it drinkable. That's amazing. But they do have problems with that, keeping the pumps keeping up with it. But what I saw was there's thousands. There's at least 2,500 people in that camp right now. And they have small tents, and it's been raining, so they have these tents, like, totally encased in plastic.
Okay,
and what I see that being is a total, you know, it's a setup for being so sick because there's no air to breathe in those little tents. And you might have a family of 3 or 5 just in a tiny little area.
And they are getting sick in increasing numbers. Kathy, I'm sorry to cut you short. I just have a half hour, and we're at the bottom of the hour now. And so I thank you very much for your addition to these reports. And back to Arun, we were tying it all together. We have about a minute and a half left. Are you still there, Arun?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. So, we're talking. So, yes, I think you're absolutely right in that this is a growing fascistic threat, what we're seeing on both sides of the border, right? Because ethno-nationalism, this violent ethno-nationalism that Trump is promoting, he's promoting these violent far-right groups. He endorses them. Remember, he called neo-Nazis who had just murdered Heather Heyer very, very fine people. He said they're very fine people on both sides. Well, that includes neo-Nazis who just murdered someone in Charlottesville. But they need targets. They need scapegoats, and that's what these immigrants represent.
Okay, we are losing that audio again. Arun, I don't know if you can hear me, but if you can, I want to thank you very much for joining me.
Yeah, sorry about maybe we can do a show when there's better.
Yeah, well, you know, it's sort of like listening to shortwave back in the day, but it's good to get the details and a report from the border. Arun Gupta, journalist with The Intercept, previously with The Guardian, thank you so much for joining me today on KBOO Portland.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. That pretty much wraps up our time coming up, Fight the Empire with Para Fagering, and you've been listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM from our great big red and white transmitter on the West Hills and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.